Good morning. I want to welcome you this morning. We're glad that you are here today. We've got several people watching online as well. We're glad they're watching us with us this morning. We hope everything is going well with you. First of all, a quick word. Bob and Rosemary are gone for the day. They are on a vacation, a very needed vacation. Usually they go to Red River this time of year. Of course, that's been canceled, but they are still taking some time out. I think they're watching the deer lease, making sure everything's good at the deer lease or somewhere out there. I don't know, somewhere. This is what he told me they might be. Anyway, but they're gone for today, and they will be back next week. I do want to say also thank you real quickly to Regina Sugg one more time. And Regina told me that Lisa Bates, actually it's Lisa Bates Watson. Anyway, Lisa helped out with that. Lisa's, I forgot, I've always put... Natalie. Whew. Takes a minute. There's a little few cobwebs back there. They'll push on through. Natalie, I always put Natalie a year younger than Turner, but she and Turner are the exact same age. So anyway, they're both sophomores coming up into juniors this year. And so Lisa helped out a lot. So we wanted to say thank you to Lisa and Regina for putting everything together this morning with our seniors and our senior celebration time. Hopefully you got a chance to see some of that this morning. We do have the Bibles. Thank you to Ken. Ken ran home and ransacked my house and got the Bibles. I'm sure he left some great surprises for me while he was there. But they are back in the back, and I put them on each table. So there's a Bible on Corey's table. There's a Bible on Laura's table. And then there's one out here right around the corner for Noah Pierce, and then there's also one in the home front area on the table in there for Noah. So if you want to take a time, just assign something, you know, tell them that you're thinking about them, you'll be praying for them as they transition in life, write those in those Bibles and put them in there. You'll notice Laura's does look a little different from the rest of them. She already had one very similar to the ones that we normally buy, so she picked out a little different one, or we picked out a different one that would be just a little bit different for her, so it's on her table out there too. So I think, is there anything else? I think I got all those announcements this morning. We're going to talk a little bit about this morning, and you know, I don't get to preach very often, especially now with Corona. Bob's here all the time, so I don't get to preach very often, so I don't get to step on toes very often, so I got to get all my toes stepping all at one time. So I'm going to apologize in advance if I step on your toes this morning. Understand I'm stepping on mine as well. I tend to preach out of what's going on in my life, so anything that I talk about are usually always things that happen. But things I need to hear as well and be reminded of. That's kind of where it blinds me. And I'm like, oh, well, if this happened to me, maybe someone else, it's happened to someone else also. You remember the show, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? Remember that show? We loved that show. We were watching that show, you know, geography and history coming up. Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? Anyway, and you kind of were like, how in the world do these fifth graders know all this stuff, right? I mean, it hadn't been that long ago. I should know some of this stuff. Have they really changed math that much in the time that I learned it till today? I mean, numbers are numbers. How can math change that much? And yet, these fifth graders seem to show us up all the time. Well, in our house, we have a running joke that goes around in our house because, you know, if we ever need any humor, if we ever need anything, we can always count on Harry, who actually has been a fifth grader this past year, right? We can always count on him to bring the fifth grade element into the family circle. So like last night, we had a little nook area where Leonard was sitting watching TV and stuff and sitting down there, and we're all kind of in there talking real quick, and all of a sudden it's just me and Emery's not home yet. It's just me and Laura and Lena, and we're kind of talking and laughing about things, and all of a sudden Harry hears the action, right? So here Harry comes around the corner. He wants to be a part of the action. But a fifth grader doesn't just come into the action and just be a part of the action, just sit. A fifth grader doesn't just kind of listen to see what's going on and then kind of fit themselves in. A fifth grader makes a statement when they walk in the room, right? So here comes Harry walking around the corner. He sees everybody laughing and he knows it's my job to add to the laughter, right? So what does he do? Up comes the shirt, hand under the arm, right? Right around the corner. Now the running joke in our house is not the fact that he's a fifth grader or that his humor is, you know, fifth grader humor, but it's always the fact that the one person that he can count on to bust out laughing at his humor is Lena. Because down deep, we are all convinced that Lena is a fifth grader, right? She is not just a fifth grader, she is a fifth grade boy, right? That is her. If the joke has anything to do with bottoms, strange sounds, right, anything along those lines, she is going to roll on the floor in laughter. That's just maybe why she married me. I'm not passing judgment here, but she always told me I made her laugh, so I'm not sure how that works for me. But anyway, we always joke with her that she's kind of a fifth grader. And so the idea, though, about fifth graders trying to learn how to be adults, right? Fifth graders are kind of awkward. We were at a church conference one time, we were listening to a session on children's ministry, and there was this lady who'd been involved in children's ministry for years and years and years and years and years. And she made this statement. She said, I am convinced that the blowfish, the only purpose in the world that we have the blowfish in our environment, was that God created it for fifth grade boys. Only purpose. Now, if you know anything about the blowfish lives in the deep, unexplored waters, right? It's mysterious, which fifth grade boys love, right? When it gets scared, it puts on its defenses. Its defenses, it looks like this little bitty fish, right? But when it gets scared, and it blows up really big, right? And it blows up with these giant spikes coming in from all different directions, right? Just what fifth grade boys love, right? Oh, action. Oh, big giant. She said, but the real reason, the true reason that a blowfish is made for fifth grade boys is because the blowfish's final act of defiance, final point of defense, is it has this black ink that masks everything so it can swim away, and the black ink shoots out its bottom. Just what little boys love to hear, right? Ooh, black ink coming from a fish's bottom. That is cool, right? That's a fifth grade boy. That's supposed to be funny, folks. You're not laughing at that. Something's wrong with you guys. A blowfish. Platypus is second, right? No one puts a duck bill on a big thing. But the blowfish made for fifth grade boys. Fortunately, in our house, we have a fifth grade boy, so we always get to keep up on the latest jokes, all the stuff that's going around, all the fun stuff. But we also have two girls in our household, or have had two girls in our household, that are older than that fifth grade boy. So I hope, my hope is that this fifth grade boy will eventually grow up to be a very stable, understanding, caring, compassionate teenager. I know those things don't usually go together in one sentence, but maybe that will happen, and he'll transition to a young man someday, and he'll be, you know, some apple of some girl's eye, perhaps. But to get there, he's going to have to take some lessons from his sisters, right? So we're glad that he has a couple of sisters, and he's not always happy about that, right? He's been thrilled this week because Emery's been gone all week long. He's had the house to himself. It's been great. She came home last night, and he's like, it's over. Oh, she's back. But the truth is, he actually learned some things from her. Well, one night, a couple of weeks ago, 3 or 4 weeks ago, we were having a conversation, and we were talking about boys, right? The girls were talking about boys. And what's the problem? And the number one problem, do you know what the number one problem for a teenage or a tweenage girl with boys? What's the biggest problem that boys, the biggest mistake that boys make? They talk about what? Themselves, right? They talk about themselves. Hey, how are you? My name's Harry, right? I can make arm sounds with my, my elbow. Hey, you want to see what I can do? Hey, you want to come watch? Hey, you want to see? Hey, you know what I... This is what a fifth grade boy does. We understand that. But if he ever wants to be someone special, right? If he ever wants to build a relationship with someone, he's got to do something different, right? He can't talk about himself. Who does he talk about? The girls. That's right. Thank you. You guys can talk a little bit. It's okay. He talks about the girl, right? When you meet somebody, what's the best thing you do? You don't talk about me, you talk about them. And so hopefully Harry is learning this idea. He was in there and we were talking to him and said, Harry, if you don't do anything else, if you don't get anything else, if you can't figure out how to put your hair down, if you can't figure out how to dress, none of those kind of things, maybe I don't know what you can, if nothing else, just understand that when you're with someone, don't talk about yourself. Talk about them. I think there's a lot of lessons for us to learn from a fifth grader. Right? Fifth graders love how to have fun. We need to know how to have fun. Go with Bobby sometime. You'll learn how to have fun. We have some good fun. Bobby and I have done some crazy things together. We've acted more like third graders than fifth graders at times. But fifth graders have to eventually learn how to be adults, right? And transition from the world of me to the world of them, to someone else. And actually, I think this is a really biblical concept, right? As Christians, we are called to be smarter than fifth graders. We are called to be people who don't engage in ourselves, but engage in someone else. And in a time like we have had in the past 4 or 5 months, and actually we'll probably have for the next several months as well, it becomes more and more difficult to find ways to engage someone else. Now, I'm going to tell you that the church leadership here for a long time has talked about how do we reach people in our community. And one of the things is not just here, but it's everywhere. Churches are talking about how do we reach younger generations, right? How do we reach young people? How do we get them to understand the message of Jesus? How do we get them to understand what the Bible and what God has to offer for folks? Well, one thing is knowing about them. They recently did a survey. We had a survey that's done by a company called Axis that we use a lot of youth ministry information from. We use it for our young parents. They send out emails and stuff. They did a survey recently, and they did a survey of people, two different generations, millennials and Gen Zers, right? Okay, so some of you are baby boomers, right? Some of you are baby boomers. Some of you are the next generation, Gen X. That's what I am, a Gen Xer, right? And then below Gen Xer, we have what we call the millennials, the much maligned millennials, right? We can talk all day about millennials. Most of it's not true, but we like to talk about millennials a lot. And then right behind millennials, younger than millennials, we have Gen Z, Generation Z. So you have Generation X, millennials were Y, and then you have Z. So Z is kind of like less than 20, 22, 23, a little bit less than 20. Peyton is actually right on the edge of Z and millennial. He's kind of smack there, dab in the middle of those two generations. He's 21. Anyway, they did a survey and they asked, what is the most important thing facing the world right now? This was about 3 weeks ago. What's the most important issue facing the world right now? Millennials answered, the most important thing facing the issue is COVID-19, right? This whole thing. Trying to stay safe, being afraid of the virus, trying to figure out how to navigate the virus. Now, that makes sense because a lot of those folks are in the throes of their careers. They're working. They're trying to figure out how to keep working. Are they staying at home? Are they going, well, how are we going to do this? They've got young families trying to figure out how to keep their young families safe. Parents want to make sure their kids are not in danger. So that makes sense. COVID-19 is the number one thing. Gen Zers have a whole different issue. Theirs is racial tension. Racial discord, anger between groups of people, the number one issue. Now, frankly, that poses a problem sometimes. I'm not a millennial. I'm not a Gen Zer. And sometimes my issues and the things that I think about some of those issues are completely different than what they think about those issues. And yet when my kids come home at the end of the day, although they don't ever leave right now, they're always at home. But at the end of the day, when I start to talk about my kids, if I want to have a meaningful relationship with my kids, I've got to talk about things that matter to them. Talk about things that matter to them. So I've got to figure out this thing about COVID-19. I've got to figure out this thing about racial tensions. I've got to figure out how I can reach them and how I can talk to them in a meaningful way that opens them up and lets them know that I care about them, and yet at the same time share perhaps the wisdom that I'd like to share about them. I want to talk today real quickly about how we do that, because in our world we kind of get cooped up, so we get stuck together. We're not real sure how we're going to reach out. As Christians, we are called into relationship. Right? I don't call myself a Christian because I go to church on Sunday morning. I don't call myself a Christian because at some point in the past I was baptized. I don't call myself a Christian because I was raised in the church. I don't call myself a Christian because I have a Bible or a fish on the back of my car. I don't call myself a Christian because most of my friends are Christian. I don't call myself a Christian because I live in a Christian nation. I don't call myself a Christian because I do things that other Christians do. I call myself a Christian because I have a relationship with Jesus. Jesus the Christ. And I want to be a Christ follower. And therefore, I am a Christian. Someone who follows Christ. I can't follow Him without a relationship. I have to have a relationship. It's not about... All those things are important. All those things I just listed out, those are not bad things. Right? Those are not things we want to get rid of or things that don't make a difference. But they're not the important thing as it is the relationship. About having a relationship with a man. I can have a relationship with a building. I can have a relationship with a little symbol on my car. I can have a relationship with a book. But ultimately, I've got to have a relationship with the man who also happens to be God. The Son of God. And what's more, we're not just called to be relationship with Jesus, because God desires us to have a relationship with Him, but we're called to be in a relationship with each other. We're called to be in relationship with each other. So how do we do that? Sometimes I'm not the same as everybody else. I'm different than everyone else. Trust me, I understand. I am different than a lot of people. I get that. I really am. Bobby's nodding his head. Uh-huh. Amen. I heard that amen back there. Bobby's, yeah, you're a little bit different. Right? Have a thumbs up. How do I get to know? How do I pursue other people? Should I pursue other people? If we're going to be calling ourselves a Christian, we are called to a life of pursuing other people. So the question is, how do I do that? I love the idea. Now, I come from a journalism background. I used to work in a newspaper, work in a radio station. My favorite thing in the world is to get someone on the radio with me and just have a conversation with them. Because I understand a truth about people, that everyone has a story. Everyone has a story. We may not look the same. Bobby and I definitely don't look the same. Still got mine. Right? Nitra and I don't look the same. Gabriel and I don't look the same. Ken and I we look a lot alike, but not exactly the same. Yeah. He's got more upper arms than I do. Okay? We each have our stories. It doesn't matter where we came from. It doesn't matter the culture we have. It doesn't matter the color of our skin. It doesn't matter how tall or how short we are. We all have stories. We have a story of where we've been. And even if we look very similar to each other, even if we're mistaken for each other, our stories are so completely different. So the first thing that we have to make sure we're doing is saying, hey, what is your story? Tell me your story. You realize that when Jesus came to the world and He ministered to people, He didn't usually just get up and start preaching. Now, there are some occasions where He actually gets up and preaches to large crowds. But more often, what He did was build relationships, and He always started relationships with a question. He started out by asking a question of people. It's a great example for us. My encouragement to you is find someone in your world. Find someone who you walk past or you don't talk to or you haven't seen in a while. Call them on the phone if you have to. FaceTime if you really want to. Or if you just happen to be close enough and you're, you know, everybody's comfortable with it. Then have a conversation and start with this question. Tell me your story. Doug, I played golf this week. It's the first time I played golf in about 5 years. And it showed. Whew! I was bad. I had like 2 good hits the whole time. But it was fun. Because I played with people I've never played before with, right? It was a school thing. It was school administrators. I sat in a cart with a guy who's a police officer on campus. Now, let me tell you what. You want to have someone difficult to talk to, sit next to a police officer, right? Police officers don't give up their story easily, right? I'm like, hey, so where are you from? Here. Okay, you got kids?
Yep.
How many you got?
Two.
So what do you enjoy? Do you like school police officer better than like police department police officer? I mean, what's better?
Yeah.
Man, it was like pulling teeth.
But for 4.5 hours, we worked on it.
And at the end of the day, I got to know a new guy. We kind of became friends. Kind of an interesting fellow. Grew up in Kilgore, I found out eventually. His dad was a police chief there. Went to school there. He's been in school here as a police officer for many years. What does it matter? It matters because now we have a relationship with each other. Right? Now we have an opportunity to talk about things that transcend the weather and kids and that kind of stuff. And we get a chance to talk about what the next question, which is, hey, can I ask you some stuff? Would you like to talk sometime about your life? How do you feel about where you're going? Now, some people don't want to talk about it, and that's fine. So really, the second question becomes, can we talk or do you want me? I can just listen. Can we just listen? My daughter, who's graduating, Laura, who's graduating, she has this interesting thing about sick at her stomach. She doesn't like to get sick at her stomach, you know. I don't know many of us who do. But for many of us, you know, you take a pill, you take medicine, maybe you sit, you put washcloth in your forehead, whatever. None of that works for Laura. The only thing that works for Laura is talking. So in order to help her through the night when she gets her stomach upset, what you have to do is sit and talk with her. Let her talk to you, actually. It's not really talking. She's the one that's doing the talking. So many a night, 2 or 3 hours at a time, not me, my wife has sat in the bathroom with Laura listening. And it's like, I'm like, what do you talk about? I can hear him through the window, or through the door. Linda's going, okay, so how was your day today? Oh, it was good. I got up this morning. She's just drawing. But it makes things better. Sometimes we just need to talk. You ever had that happen? Husbands, have you ever had that happen when, because husbands are fixers. We like to fix things. So your wife comes home and she's talking. You're like, oh, I can take care of this. And she's like, stop it. Just listen to me. And sometimes you don't get that. Sometimes it takes like a lot of times of trying to fix things. And finally she gets mad and upset. And you're like, I don't know why you're upset. I'm trying to fix you. You told me this thing. Obviously you want me to fix this thing. And she's like, no, I don't want you to fix it. I just want you to listen. Have you ever had that? I don't want you to fix it. I just want you to listen. It's a great story in Job. Job chapter 6. You know, Job's sitting down there. He's had his whole family taken from him. He's had his wealth taken from him. And his friends come around. And one of his friends are like, let me tell you what I think you should do. Right? And they go wax on eloquently for multiple chapters. And finally, Job, in Job chapter 6, finally he says, just listen. Basically, it's not quote that, but basically he says, just, my words are like wind, just listen for a minute. It's a great example of lament. Sometimes we, as Christians, don't always understand the concept of lament, right? We try to put on a happy face all the time for everybody outside, and then go home and crush ourselves on the inside by ourselves. But really, Job gives a great example of lamenting, of crying out in pain, crying out in anger. To God, in fact. What did Jesus do on the cross in the agony and anguish of what was going on? Why have you forsaken me? Like this idea, was he forsaken? No. David does this all the time in the Psalms. He writes Psalms of lament. The pain is overwhelming. I feel crushed by a stone. Now, do we need those things fixed? Well, yeah, we need those things fixed, but sometimes we just need to vent, to rant. Sometimes, if you're someone who needs to vent, always need someone to be vented to, right? Someone just to listen. Just someone to say, hey, I'm here. Go for it. I hear your pain. I can't fix it. Can't do anything else. You know, right now we see racial reconciliation is one of the big things we're talking about. Gen Zers, racial reconciliation is the big problem that's facing the world. You know, races, I don't think, I heard someone say the other day, races can't reconcile. People can. Races don't reconcile, people do. Now, I don't think for 1 minute that I can go out and reconcile a whole group of people to a whole other group of people, but I can, just myself, reconcile me to someone else. To build one relationship at a time, one to the other. I think I've told you the story before. A few years ago, you remember when the Dallas shooting happened? The police officers, the guy that shot several police officers in Dallas, is also in the midst of a big kind of racial tension that was going on in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and across the nation, in fact. We were going to Sooner that week. The next week, we went to Sooner camp. The first night at Sooner, I wound up sitting down at a table. It was just the counselors kind of sitting around shooting the breeze, just having a good time, just kind of relaxing and kicked back. D'Angelo was one of the other counselors with me. It was the second year that we'd been there together. D'Angelo is an African-American gentleman who's got a master's degree in youth ministry, working on his doctorate. And sitting across the table, I thought, here we are, two guys, white, black, in this camp, trying to teach kids about Jesus when the world around us seems to be falling apart. How do we do this? And I looked at him and I said, D'Angelo, tell me your story. Where'd you come from? And for the next hour and a half, I listened to a young man who grew up in a world not far from mine, but miles away culturally. Miles away. And we had a long conversation. We had a conversation about police officers. We had a conversation about traffic being stopped in the middle of the night, how you deal with things like that, conversations that I'd never had to have with my family, conversations that I'd never experienced before. And some of that time, I just let him rant. Some of the time, he lamented. And some of the times, we had conversation. And that week was such a blessing to me because of the relationship that we built and the understanding that I gained by seeing life through someone else's eyes. Seeing life through someone else's eyes. There's a couple of stories in the Bible I want to hit on real quickly before we wrap up that bring this into light. You know, Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 through 5 says, "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourself, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others." And I forget this more than anything else. I forget this more than anything else. It's not too difficult for me to start judging other people. It's not too difficult for me to start laying blame at other people's feet for the things that I see that are happening. Why? Because it makes me feel better. Oh, look, somehow I am better because I didn't do that. Well, I know that's a horrible situation, but they got themselves into it. I saw on Facebook the other day, I hesitate to bring this up, and I don't want to step on any toes, but I saw on Facebook the other day a comment that I probably would have made not too long ago. And it was talking about the racial issues and police officers and all that kind of stuff, and the comment simply was simply words, and it simply said, "How come no one's saying, if you don't want to be harassed by cops, don't do illegal things?" And I understand that. Like I said, I probably would have agreed with that not too long ago, right? If a cop's stopping you, well, you obviously did something. You did something to make them stop. They don't just stop people for no reason. I had a conversation with D'Angelo that night in Sooner. I asked D'Angelo, I said, "D'Angelo, how many times have you been stopped by a police officer?" He goes, "My whole life?" I was like, I don't know, no, like in the past year. At the time, D'Angelo was living in Stamford, Texas, just south of Abilene. He was going to school in Abilene at ACU to getting his master's, finishing up his master's. And so he'd drive back and forth to Stamford. He goes, "Well, I've been in Abilene for a year now." He goes, "I've been stopped 7 times in Abilene." I said, 7 times? said, yeah. I said, how many times do you get a ticket? He goes, never. I said, how many times do you get a warning? He said, never. And I said, okay, be honest, straight up with me, D'Angelo. How many times were you doing something you should have been stopped for? He said, once. I was like, hey, he's honest. You know, once. Now, why is that hurtful for someone? Why the comment to say, don't do something illegal if you don't want to be harassed? Because sometimes that's not the reality people come from. Never happened to me. Every time I was stopped by a cop, I was doing something I should have been stopped for. Every single time. I can honestly say, if I don't want to be stopped, I probably shouldn't do something illegal. It's a pretty good reason not to be stopped. Sometimes that's not always the case. But again, I can't change that by a whole group of people. I can only change my relationship once at a time. And I can reconcile one person at a time. Because that's what God calls me to do. Because the problem is not illegal things. The problem is not racial discord. The problem is not all of these things, like COVID or virus or conspiracy or anything else. It's none of that is the problem. The problem is sin. The problem is we live in a broken world. And we live in a world that Philippians talks about is probably more often about me than anybody else. How can I do better? By being humble. By doing nothing out of vain conceit and thinking about others as more important than me. Well, if I did that all the time, do you know how much easier life would go for me? And do you know how much easier it would be to win people for Jesus? But I put my foot in the mouth all the time. And I make myself feel better. And a little more mercy is needed from God. Because I've messed up again. My encouragement to you is this. We can't reconcile races. We can't reconcile large groups of people all at once. We can't bring racial harmony. We can't bring peace to a world that's scared about a virus or a world who thinks the virus is fake. We can't settle those issues at all. But all I can do is have a relationship with God, a God that calls me to pursue others like He has pursued me. There's a passage in the New Testament in Luke chapter 13. It's kind of an interesting passage. Sometimes it's used as something that's kind of a strange passage because it's kind of out of nowhere. Luke chapter 13. I'll read from the NET version here. Jesus has been preaching to large groups of people in Luke chapter 13, verse 1. He says, now there were some present on that occasion who told him about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. Okay? And Jesus says, he answered them, do you think these Galileans were worse sinners than all the other Galileans because they suffered these things? And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. That doesn't make much sense. Let me give you a little bit of context, a little bit of background what's going on here. We have a story from Josephus, who is a Jewish historian. We don't have anything else in the Bible about this story. The only thing we can go to is Josephus, who tells the story about Pilate. Pontius Pilate, the one who eventually is going to crucify or help to crucify Jesus. Pilate has this order that says he brings in all these military emblems into Jerusalem, and the Jews get angry about it, right? The Jews get all upset because these emblems are kind of idolatrous in their eyes, and so they want them out. And Pilate kind of says, no, this is going to happen, and the Galileans get all, the group of people from the Jewish people, get all up in arms, and they're like, no, we're going to stop this, and there kind of becomes a standoff between the two of them. And Pilate hides soldiers in Jewish clothing in the midst of the people, and when the people start protesting these idols, what they are considering idols around the temple, the soldiers take off their clothes and start slaughtering the Jews. In the midst of the temple, some of them with their sacrifices in hand, these soldiers start slaughtering these Jews as a way for Pilate to say, look, I am in charge. Okay? And what's happened over the years is this story has kind of become famous, and there's a debate that's grown out of it that has said, who's responsible for dying in the temple? Was it Pilate, or was it the Jews? Well, Pilate obviously is the one that gave the order. He's the one that started it all. He's the one that organized his soldiers to be out there and eventually said, slaughter them if they rise up. But you know there's a Jewish mother somewhere out there saying, if you don't go down there, you won't get killed. You don't show up. You shouldn't be protesting. You shouldn't be out there. So the Jews came up with this idea of who's at fault. Is it the Jews who showed up there that got themselves slaughtered? Because everything that happens obviously is something from God. It's a sign from God one way or another. So it's like the idea of who sinned if the guy can't walk? All right, if the guy can't walk, he's been struck lame. Who's responsible for the sin that caused the lameness? So the Jews are asking, who's at sin? It's a debate. Who's at fault here? Was it Pilate or was it the Jews? Who's responsible for the people dying? And Jesus nails them with the comment that says, do you think these Galileans were worse sinners than all the others, namely you, because they suffered these things? Sounds insensitive at first, but what Jesus is actually saying, he says, wait a minute. If you're trying to lay blame either at the Jews or at Pilate, you're missing the point. Because by doing that says you're a little bit better because obviously you weren't there. You would never order someone dead. You wouldn't go protest like that. So, you know, it's a bad situation, but they shouldn't have probably been there to begin with. Jesus says, look, do you think they're worse than you? No, no. You need to repent, he says. You need to repent. He says, he goes on, no, I tell you that unless you repent, you will perish as well. A lot of times, we look at the world around us, and we see all the bad things happening, and we think, well, at least it's not happening to me. Maybe I'm a little bit better. Right? This is that fifth grade mentality. It's not about me. Jesus says, you need to work on your own sin. You need to work on your own sin. And then you can reconcile. This is tough. This is really, really tough. Because it makes me feel better when I find out that some people who've been treated badly were actually criminals. It makes me feel better. Hey, at least I'm not a criminal. It makes me feel better that hey, well, maybe they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. God says that none of that stuff matters. What matters is you deal with your sin, you get your relationship right, and then you pursue others for me. We talked before about the story of the prodigal son, right? We love the story of the prodigal son. Guy, he leaves, he goes out, we know what's going to happen. The dad says, okay, whatever, go do it. And they go out, he wastes all this money and he comes back, but he comes back to his, comes to his senses and he says, oh, what have I done? I realize I've lost all this. I've done the wrong thing. I'm going to go back to my father. And he goes back, humble, by the way, he goes back to his father, groveling for just a job, not to be a part of the family again, but just to be, just have a job. And what does the father do? He throws his arms open and says, come on back to me. We love that story of redemption, right? We love that story of that God is going to welcome me back no matter what I've done. And it's true, no matter what I've done, no matter how bad it is, when I humble myself before Him and turn from my wicked ways and come back to Him, He will heal me and He will reconcile with me and take me back in. It's a great story, right? That wasn't the point of the story. When Jesus told the story, He was telling it to Jews. Jewish followers who had a faith. He wasn't talking to ones who had left and come back. He was talking to the Jews who were part of the religious establishment. The point of the story was not that they were the prodigals or they might be the prodigals, but rather they are the older son. They were the older son. Because what did the older son do? He got mad when the younger son came back and received the mercy and grace that he received. Now, we don't know whatever happened because the story ends. We don't have the final decision of what happens to the older son. But Jesus stopped, I think, right there to drop the point, kind of mic drop kind of thing. Here's the point. Don't be the older son. When the younger son left, the father gave everything he had to him. He split the inheritance, gave one to the older, gave one to the younger, and sent them all off. The point of the prodigal son story is this. The father chose to let the young man go because that was his desire. Who should have gone after the younger son? Who should have pursued the younger son and convinced him that what he was doing was wrong and he needed to come back? Who? The brother. The older son. The father had made the decision. The young man had turned against the father. There was nothing else the father could do. But who was left to go pursue the young man and bring him back to the family? Jesus tells this story because he sets himself up, obviously, as the older brother. That Jesus is the older brother, not the older brother in the story, but the older brother who the older brother should have been. The Son of God come to a world pursuing you and me on behalf of the Father, convincing us, persuading us to come back and be welcomed by the Father with open arms. That's the story of the prodigal son. That first we may be the prodigal that comes back and be welcomed, but that we become the older brother, the wiser one, the one who should have more experience, who's not the fifth grader anymore, but the one who is willing to pursue others and bring them back to God. That's the story. That's the joy of the prodigal son. That we be that brother. How do we pursue people? We seek after them. We ask them the question, tell me your story. We ask them, can I share you my story? Can I tell you what I think? Or do you just want me to listen? Because in your pain sometimes, I'm ready to just listen, if that's all it takes. If that's all you can do right now, I'm ready to listen. Tell me your story. Because folks, as the church, as Christians that we are, we've got dibs on the best story in the world. We've got the inside goods on the story that will change their lives. It doesn't matter where they came from. It doesn't matter what culture they're part of. It doesn't matter the color of their skin. It doesn't matter the size of their pocketbook. It doesn't matter any of that kind of stuff. What they've done, the story that we have to share with them, will change their life forever. And in turn, will make them transformed into someone who could pursue others as well. That's the story of Jesus. That's the prodigal son. That's the humble yourself. And comes back to the whole story. Chapter 6, book of Micah. What do we do? I've told you, old man. Love, justice, do mercy, seek mercy. Walk humbly with your God. It's all right there. Justice, mercy, humility. As we seek to reconcile, not the world. We can't fix the world. We're not going to fix Corona. We're not going to fix race relations. We're not going to fix politics. Don't even try. Well, you might want to try, but it's not going to be helpful. We can't do it. All we can do is fix our relationship with God and call others to the same. And that's my encouragement to you this morning. If there's anything that we can do to help you along that way, if there's anything that we can bring to bear, the congregation here wants to pray with you, that leadership wants to pray with you about that, we want to be a part of reconciliation, reconciling one person to another, to God. And do that in a way that changes lives. The Bible says transformation of the mind to make someone completely new. You still have your story, and that story simply becomes a powerful tool to change someone else's life. That's my encouragement for you this morning. If there's anything we can do, if there's any prayer requests we can fill,